we'll start with ultra-short period planets. Actually, first we're going to start with SUSY. I think it was Rachel was complaining about bad acronyms earlier. SUSY has an excellent acronym, because this is, we are the short period planet group, which becomes super pig if you kind of squint. All right, so the short period planets have been like this thing in exoplanets ever since 51 Peg was said, what is this planet doing so close to its star? Well, the answer is it's hanging out with all of the other planets that are super close to their stars. This is showing all the periods out to 5 days, and you can see here are the hot Jupiters, here's a whole bunch of hot small things, and there's not a whole lot in the middle. This is called the sub-Jovian desert. In particular, there's like nothing below about 1.5 days, between about 3 and 11 Earth radii. And we're going to be focusing on the stuff less than 1 day. So that's this plot zoomed in. And we can see a whole lot of interesting structure in this plot, which I'll get to later. The purple things are the ones I'm going to talk to. These are all of the K2 planets up through campaign 10 that we've been looking through. And there's a few wacky things, like pulsars and white dwarfs can have planets and a little closer, but there's really nothing below. The shortest confirmed one has a period of about 4 hours. And then for hot Jupiters, the shortest one is about 19 hours, which is right at the Roche limit for something that's half gram density. So the interesting thing is here, filling in this diagram and explaining how it got there. All right, so on to K2. That's K2. maybe I got the pictures wrong when I Googled for it. So on the exoplanet follow-up website today, there are 32 planets listed as candidate ultra-short period planets, meaning their periods are less than 1 day, of which about half of them have been confirmed or validated, and there are 7 multi-planet systems. And our results are reanalyzing all of the data from K2, and we've basically doubled the number of candidates, confirmed a bunch more, and have ruled out a few of these candidates as being false positives. I don't really talk about validation very much. So, anyhow, and that's possible due to Everest, which is a new photometry pipeline. And this photometry pipeline is 25 to 50% more precise than the previous one, which we've been using. And it turns out that really matters, because there's a lot of really small stuff, and the closer you get into the noise, the more small things you find. Here's an example of a planet that you could see there's a transit there very marginally. The signals and noise is just under the cutoff of 7 that we commonly use for this particular case. But like, it's just so much clearer with this new photometry package, and this is repeated on all of the light curves. And this is really important, because there are things that are smaller than Earth. There keep being more planets. I don't know how low the we saw there was an upper cutoff in the short period desert. There's not much above about 2 or 3 Earth radii, but below that we don't know how small these things get, how close. But the difference it's made is huge. In the K2SFF data, only about 10% of the first couple campaigns and like 30 to 50% of later campaigns could find things that had Earth's radius around a G-type star. And in Everett, it's like 55 to 70%. So
what's the difference between the two?
That's a magic. No. That is a great question. I can refer you to the paper, but it's just a completely different way of processing the light curves. But the key is that these are both available for download, so we don't have to like...
Would it help for dissecting oscillations?
Sorry?
Would it help for dissecting oscillations in these stars?
Yeah. I don't know exactly. So it uses, Everest uses a Gaussian process analysis to sort of marginalize over the systematics, whereas K2SFF does this model fitting, I think, for the photos, the center...
centroid. It's basically doing a fit to try to deconvolve the centroid motion and the photometric variability.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So,
The moral of the story of this is that it's really useful to just go back and write better photometry pipelines.
But I think the Gaussian process probably would take out your oscillations.
Yeah.
That's basically what it's doing. Yeah. It's finding the oscillations in the spacecraft and removing them. So right. I think that the star had oscillation.
Well, it depends maybe on the time scale. I don't actually know what Everest really does, but it has like a time window where it looks for the oscillations that are K2. It might be in a different time domain.
So that's possibly
Q2
then.
Okay.
But you know, Gaussian processes don't work quite like that. Where it's not like a Fourier analysis.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you fit a kernel with has some.
It's a covariance.
The kernel will have some width to it, and that sets the time scale. So if the time scale is different, I think it's. I'm not sure you would necessarily remove 5 minute solar oscillations. 5 minute solar oscillations.
What's the case?
Right, because then you would think you'd be suppressing the transits, right? If you were removing really short periods, you'd be suppressing the transits. Yeah. That doesn't happen.
This is all 30 minute cadence, right?
Oh, sure, yeah, of course, that's right. Okay.
Yeah. All right. This is just another plot showing all of the new planets we've discovered. The white blue is bigger planets, so I guess where is it? There's these little tiny G's down here, which is Earth around a G-type star, 0.1. That's all down in the, 10 to 20% chance of finding any given planet there. If this stuff, bigger planets, which would be up here, we would find if they were there, and there's a few, but there's just really nothing. All right, so let's move on to some multi-planet systems. About 10%, exactly 10% of our sample was part of a multi-planet system. These are all planets that have been reported elsewhere, but I'm plotting them all on the scale. This is my entirely to scale plot that I showed you at the opener on Monday, and now I have the other planets on here. I fixed the bug in my code. This is all in terms of everything is here plotted on solar radii. And we can see a couple of interesting things. The first is that mostly the planets are fairly separated from their stars. From the other planets in the system. And then there are a lot of 3 and 4 planet systems, about half of them, 4 of these 7 planets are systems where we know of at least 3 or 4 transiting planets, and there may be additional non-transiting planets that we haven't found further out. In fact, probably all of them have companions, just based on geometric arguments of transit detectability. There's been some discussion back and forth about whether or not they look the same as other Kepler systems, if the USPs are a little further separated from their next planet in their system, and a little perhaps. So this paper is arguing they're more likely to have planet companions in 10 to 50 days rather than 1 to 10 day orbits nearby. But this is all work in progress. All right. So how did they get there? The first idea is maybe they formed where we found them. Well, the answer is mostly no, because if you look at where the disk extends to, there's usually a little bit of a gap between the disk and the star. There's actually a few planets that might have, their disks might have extended in closely enough. This red line is where the radius of the disk, or the period of the inner edge of the disk matches the orbital period. So a few of these planets could have formed near in situ, but the rest of them, their disk ended at 2 or 4 days out, and so they had to move in somehow. And that's the big question that we've always been trying to address. So before I go on, I'm going to just reiterate that we're talking about two different classes of planets, and these have different problems relating to their formation and long-term survival. So there's the ultra-hot Jupiters, these biggest guys up here, which are the tail end of the hot Jupiter population, and they really, there's a few candidates over here, but this Roche limit. I mean, so these planets over here, these candidates over here could be experiencing Roche lobe overflow, or they could be background eclipsing binary blends, because that's also, we haven't ruled out that possibility for a bunch of these objects. So these are very interesting ones to go follow up on, because they could be super cool dynamical objects if they're not fake.
It would be extremely cool to have a plot like this and as a function of density rather than radius, because that's the main thing for Roche lobe thing.
And these guys mostly have mass measurements. Most of these don't. But not
you get limits.
You can get limits, for sure.
For the ones that are Jupiter-sized candidates and really close in, is it just because the stars are really, really faint that nobody has gone for the radial velocities? Because
for these ones, this one's our shortest period candidate, and it's in around a stupid 18th magnitude star. Like, what is the point of that? And that's for most of these. Oh, and there's a couple other. These two bug me because they are at they're at 4 hour periods and they're big. So probably false positives, but one of them's a fast rotator, so it's just really hard to get accurate spectra of it. And I forget what the deal with the other one is. I think it might be faint.
Yeah, I mean, do we have masses of the ultra-hot Jupiters?
These ones we do. Because, and here's the other interesting thing, you'll notice how none of them are purple. So K2 did not actually, I mean, K2 first 10 campaigns, we didn't find any ultra-hot Jupiters. These are ultra-hot Jupiters from ground-based surveys.
Okay.
Kepler and K2 actually did not find very many candidates in this region. And that, which means like one of two things. The first is that there's something like weird in the Kepler data processing where we're, you know, I don't know, throwing, I mean, maybe we've been throwing out things that are eclipsed, they look like eclipsing binaries because they've got secondaries, but more likely it's just they're really rare and Kepler K2 just didn't find them. Because we should have. We would have been very sensitive to finding them. Yep.
What was the other thing? You said one of two things.
I did have another thing. Yep.
Oh, sorry.
I don't remember what it is, though.
What other possibility is that they're so easily spotted that you didn't need this sophisticated method?
Sure.
New method to find new ones.
Yeah, but we should have rediscovered everything in there. I mean, this planet right here is the only one we've had this candidate, that looks like a hot Jupiter, and it popped out of our data very easily.
About the point to the right?
The point to the right, these are all black. So the purple is the K2 stuff, the black is from the literature. So mostly these are Kepler and HATs and WASPs and other things. Yeah, I don't quite know. We have a proposal in to look at for more of these using TESS, because TESS is going to look at the entire sky and it's going to look at the bright stars, and these are very super easy to detect.
So the ground-based surveys are, of course, extremely biased towards short period to p to the sixth power.
The ground-based surveys, like these, are the only ones the ground-based surveys can really find very well.
So I don't know if that explains it. This is where you're a lot more stars.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems consistent with the occurrence range.
Yeah.
Why there's no K2 longer than one day?
Because I just didn't look for longer than one day.
Okay.
This is only this is my cutoff right here, and that's actually another thing is to go out to 1.5 day. What is an ultra short period planet? Like there is sort of, there's definitely between about 2 days and 1 day. There's a little bit of a difference in their population, but we're going with 1 day.
Maybe Kepler also has cut off at 1.1 day. Kepler
used to.
Just didn't look for them.
Kepler used to, yes. That's partly why we founded the survey, is the original Kepler pipeline just stopped at 1 day.
Yeah.
And then after we found a couple, they just changed to be looking down to half a day, I think, regularly. So, the stuff, anything below about half a day, like, these planets down here are just, they require slightly different data conditioning techniques to find, because you're removing noise on different timescales, and people just don't, and you end up with so many annoying false positives in this region, because that's where all the eclipsing binary blends are. So you end up with so many false positives to sort through that people don't want to bother. All right, so let's try to figure out how those large ultra short period planets came in here. All right, idea one was that they formed there, probably not. So idea two was that they scattered inwards. The problem with this is that pure scattering just doesn't work to get planets in super close, because their pericenter has to be in an extremely unstable origin once they get scattered in. So you just can't. they would, if you scattered something in on an orbit that would eventually cause it to be at a 0.7 day period, it would be at 0.35 days initially, and it just crashes in. Never find it. Okay, so the answer is, as always, to just add some tidal decay to that, so you have some migration with the disk inwards, and couple that with the effect of tides. This is more, questions should go towards Brian about this section of the talk. But there's a whole lot of interesting unknowns about how to make tidal decay work. The biggest one being, what is the stellar Q? Which controls how fast tidal decay moves planets in. There's been some interesting work by Kalyan Penev of showing that the tidal factor Q may actually increase with decreasing orbital period. The thing being plotted down here is the tidal period, which is about twice the orbital period, so this box is at about 1 day, if I did that right.
So what's being plotted here, these are stars?
These are planets with Q values that have been estimated using stellar rotation rates, and this is where the ultra short period planets live, and there just aren't that many stars to really constrain whether this actually goes up like that or goes like that.
Just from the fact that they are still there and some guess probably on the edge of the star, you know that, or you see that. Is that what it appears?
So orbital period and the stellar rotation rate, and then some estimate on the age.
And all of these gray things are like lower limits where.
Well, not that they're still there, but that they're where they are.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Meaning that, I guess what I'm saying is that these values of Q, even though they look relatively large, don't preclude the possibility that they continue spiraling in.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of short, significantly interesting time scales.
Okay.
So what's the time scale required to bring them in from somewhere to this present limit that is determining Q's star here?
Is that a question?
Yeah. I guess I'm trying to understand what you said. So is it the dissipation factor you need in order to bring the planet to its present orbit?
To its present
orbit? The lifetime of the star, the current age of the star.
And spin up the star sufficiently. Or, and produce a star that rotates
at the right rate.
So Kahlo has both the spin evolution of the star and the orbital evolution of the planet built in. So those are the constraints, the spin rate of the star and the orbital period of the planet, and then the other parameters you know from the system.
So how is magnetic braking taken into account?
He has the Skumanich law.
And then these systems, those are presumably done for any system. How does the presence of a planet affect this Skumanich law?
He lets the star spin up in addition to allowing sort of losing momentum through the stellar wind. Is that what you're asking?
Well, there's a clear dependence on forcing frequency here.
Right.
Okay, so.
That's what he argues anyway.
Right. So, but these dispersion at any given location is quite large, right? And any frequency, if you take the frequency just on the right side of the dotted line, the dispersion, there's at least one order of magnitude in dispersion. So how does that affect the spin rate of the star?
How does the dispersion affect the spin rate of the star?
The inference, presumably this is obtained by from this stellar spin rate, okay. But some of this dispersion may be due to uncertainty, what you assume to be magnetic braking and...
Oh yeah, so he tries to marginalize over all those uncertainties, and so that's one of the reasons the error bars are so big, is that he tries to marginalize over the uncertainty in the stellar age, the uncertainty in the stellar spin, the uncertainty in the model parameters. He has this enormous Monte Carlo code that basically tries all these different things and then chooses the evolutionary trajectories that match up with the observational constraints. I'm sure that's contributing to the dispersion.
Yeah. All right. So this is another plot showing that one of the reasons we want to find these to look at these hot Jupiters is because, well, depending on how fast their tidal decay is operating, they could be on order of millions of year timescales, which is something that you can detect if with careful observations of the transit midtime for 10 or 20 years. This is my thesis, which tried to do this from the ground and had, you know, 5 null detections because we didn't have any ultra short period planets back in my day.
What would you tell the difference between orbital decay and a further body?
You just have to observe for longer. This is my next slide. So this is WASP-12, the current best contender for decaying planet. And so this is the change in orbital period that looks like about 10 years worth of data. And if it keeps going on like that for the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, then we'll guess it's orbital decay. And if it oscillates, then it's precession.
So there's, yeah, you know, there's a paper on this with Tess.
Test observe this one?
Yes. Right. Okay. And so there's are
the test. By, the test points would be like here.
Well, yeah. So basically, they rule out any. I think they or put a strong upper limit on decay.
On the decay. Yeah.
Pull up this paper.
Yeah. That does not surprise me because.
This is Avi Spora's work.
Yeah. Okay. Is that on the archive right now?
Yeah, it's already. I think it's already
published. Okay. Yep. Well, so this is the kind of thing that you're looking for, and. Nobody has found it. Nobody has conclusively found it yet, but that doesn't mean it's not something we can't start looking for. All right. What happened there? Okay, so let's move on to the little guys, the small ultra-short period planets. Back in the day, we had this idea to look for them because, well, after these hot Jupiters get super close to their stars and they hit their Roche limits and all of their gas goes away, what happens to the core? Like, does it keep going into the star or does it settle into a nice stable orbit for a few billion years? And Josh Wynn has published a paper that pretty much conclusively proves that the population of ultra-short period planets, the small ones, can't exclusively be cores of hot Jupiters. Because the metallicities just don't match. Hot Jupiter stars are well known for having higher metallicities than the typical star. This is so the yellow distribution here is showing the average hot Jupiter distribution, and the red is showing the average ultra short period planet distribution, and they are not the same. So you can do some statistical tests and show that maybe up to 30-40% of systems could have come from this population and the distributions would still match, but most of these ultra short period planets are not fossil cores. I'm just plotting our own K2 sample to show that it agrees with Josh's mostly Kepler sample. All right, just a little bit of a digression about masses and compositions because these are fun things. These ultra short period planets are the best ones for us to measure Earth-sized planets with. These are, in fact, you know, the only Earth-sized planets. This plot is actually a couple years old. There's a few more planets that should go in there, but I haven't updated it. And showing that actually most of the ultra-short period planets that we've found so far have compositions that are more or less earthy. So they've got some iron and some rock. There's no volatile, which makes sense because they are super close to their stars. But if we did find something that was very super dense over here, that would be a good indication that maybe we found the super compressed core of a hot Jupiter. All right, let's try another theory for how you get those small ultra short period planets in. Maybe they came in via resonances with some other planets. I picked these two planets because they're pretty much the only two of the only ultra short period planets that are even close to a resonance with a nearby planet. They're near a 3-to-1 and a 4-to-1, but they're not actually in resonance. They're just nearby. Most ultra-short period planets are really a long way away from their nearest companions, and their orbital period ratios are 10 or 20. So resonances alone isn't going to do it for the vast majority of these cases. So the answer is to add tides. Tides plus interactions with other planets in the system. There's a paper that I was just reading through yesterday, actually, that worked through the whole scenario using low eccentricity migration of systems of planets inwards coupled with tidal damping. And they have two interesting predictions. The first is that although they could get it to work with two planet systems sometimes, it's just easier if there's more than two planets in there, and I haven't quite understood exactly why that works, but you can go look it up. And this is interesting because about half of our multi-planet systems have three or more planets in them that we know about. And these are also, that we know about caveat, because if we think that most ultra-short period planets have at least one companion that we haven't found, well, they might have more, but those further planets are not complete by any means. So, and then the other thing is that it favors planets that are, the ultra-short period planet is small and the companions are a bit more massive, not a lot more massive. And that's actually what we found. This is something that I had been working on independently of this paper, that the median radius of these ultra-short period planets is about 1 Earth radii and their companions are about 2 Earth radii. And that makes a little bit of sense. There's a little bit of detection bias because the further you get from the star, the fewer transits you have to stack together, so you're not quite as sensitive to small planets, but it's not entirely detection bias. All right, so the future of Super Pig. Well, there's the other half of K2's data to look through. There's a lot of mess in the databases with all of the published candidates. There's a lot of unconfirmed Kepler and K2 candidates floating around. If you try to go pull up a list of ultra-short period planets from any of the databases, they're incomplete, and they're missing huge chunks of data, and they've got, like, inaccurate parameters. So that's been, like, half of my day-to-day life for making these statistics plots is just dealing with that. TESS is the really exciting thing for the future because it's, I think the second planet announced from TESS was an ultra-short period planet, and this is just what TESS is good at. In particular, we would really like to find some more of these ultra-hot Jupiters so we can start testing the tidal decay for the big things. And got a couple other things that Brian will talk about that you can do with really, really cool ultra-hot Jupiters. And finally, we're going to be doing some mass measurements of ultra-short period planets because they are very easy to measure radial velocities for because they have such short periods, so long as you can find them around cooperative big stars. So they're super big. That's our group. Mike Endel's our the third member of our team. Any questions?
Yeah, what can we learn from the disintegrating ones? Because they are basically the closest you can get.
Yeah.
You may get estimates on lifetimes. And...
That is correct. Those disintegrating planets, I've only got one of them on here, mm-hmm. which, well, that radius is actually just wrong, because...
There are now three, four?
There's three or four of them, yeah. One of the disintegrating planets is around a white dwarf, and there's, like, three around main sequence galaxies. And yeah, we need to include those guys in, but they're...
Can you elaborate a little bit more what you mean by disintegrating?
Okay, so there's three planets that are disintegrating, and that means that when they were found, their light curves... two of the cases, the light curves have a strong tail at egress, which is interpreted as a cloud of debris that's trailing behind the planet in orbit. And another one or two of them also just have variable depth, so they're like, it's maybe not a, one of them isn't described as a planet so much as a comet swarm. It's just like a bunch of things that have broken apart, so the light curves are really irregular looking.
And is the star more rapidly rotating or less rapidly rotating than the planet?
That's a really good question that I...
Well, the orbital period of the object, whatever it is very
stars,
short.
The star's got to be rotating more rapidly.
But is the velocity, the spin velocity, no?
I don't know off the top of my head what the V sine I is for those host planets, for those host stars, but it's... I don't think they're unusual in terms of rotation. So, given how short the orbital period of the object is, I don't think that the stars are
they're
faster.
Not. Yeah. They're not. They're not rapidly rotating.
Yeah. I think they're regular
sign
stars.
Causing H and K. Do you know if they're magnetic reactive?
Usually, at least two of them are fairly faint, right? I don't think they have.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the disintegrating ones in particular. Because they are very faint, but for some of the other USPs, like Kepler 78 is sort of the iconic
yes.
USP.
Yes.
That one is very active. And so
we measured that one's magnetic field, but are there others which are
magnetically active?
That would be a good thing to go look through. Yeah.
The disintegrating ones are why?
Yeah.
Okay, there's another question that I hear from Josh and his students, that these ultra short, there may have in these multiples, they have mutual. They may have mutual inclinations obliquity.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that correct?
They may.
No, I mean, there's some science that they're already. Maybe I shouldn't use the word may.
Yeah. Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That is entirely. That can be correct. I have no evidence against that, I should say.
I have no evidence for it that I can think of, but it certainly
seems like this is the Japanese postdoc of Josh Wynn and several others.
Oh, yeah, that was the plot I deleted from over here.
This is Dai.
Oh, yeah, the Dai et al. Result.
I remember talking about that. There's something goofy about the result.
That's not an obliquity result. That's a mutual inclination.
Inclination.
Right. So obliquity would be measured through. But yes, you're right. It is an angle. Right. So that plot is showing that, based on the transit durations of these ultra short period planets, that are in multis versus and singles, that the scatter in mutual inclinations in these systems is larger, is
that one.
That plot.
That's the one.
Yeah. So, this is showing the mutual inclination between detected transiting planets, based on the same major axis and stellar radii. The ultra short period planets are all down here, and this sort of curves up like this.
We were talking about this morning. I'm confused by this plot because I feel like if A over R star is bigger, then the next planet out has to be farther away.
All right. So here's the line of what's detectable, that black line. So the point is that if you are the innermost planet in a pair and you're close in as measured by A over R star of the innermost planet, you can be sort of anywhere in that space. But what's really interesting is that when the innermost planet is further away, it would still be detectable at slightly higher neutron inclinations, but there's this space here where there aren't planets detected.
Right.
And so the multis, where the innermost planet is far from the star, are more coplanar than they would need to be detected. But that's not necessarily true for the shorter period.
So can I ask about this one? Because when I saw this plot, Does the amount of space here really seem like it's significant from the amount of space here?
Right. I mean, we're talking about like two planets up here.
Right. It's largely driven by these very precise mutual inclination measurements. And one hope with, say, TESS might be that it could add a few systems to this plot. Of course, TESS will struggle to get the multi-planet systems.
Right.
Norton, do you happen to know if this is only small planets, also big planets?
This is only small planets.
There are basically no hot Jupiters, ultra hot. There's only one ultra hot Jupiter that's in a multi-planet system. That's WASP 50.
Okay.
So
the transit durations are also shorter, right? As you get close to that line.
Yeah.
So there's some detection bias.
Well, that's what I think, especially if it's grazing, you would throw it out as binary shape probably, so maybe that
does this plot, does this convince folks that this really is this trend? Because, I mean, to me, it just looks like an observational bias, but I don't have a good sense for, I haven't gone through
internet. I was pretty convinced by the paper, you're right to worry about sort of missed planets, but right, the reality is there's a huge number of detections here of multi-planet systems, and they're all clustered at these lower mutual inclinations. And if they were just, a little bit more here, they still would have been easily detectable up here.
Yes. So the argument is more about this gap here than it is necessarily about this.
What convinces me.
But we're not one or two planets, A or R star of six, one or two, just up there, and it would look the same to me, right?
Yeah.
But they're not there. But yeah, it is a small number.
So my question to you, because you're my multi-planet expert on site, is how thorough has the search been for like second planets in systems? Has there been anybody who's just gone through and like really methodically searched for every system that has a planet and looked for companions?
Jason Rowe is the expert on that.
Okay.
So I would ask him.
If you're worried about grazing, you could make a grazing line too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know how different it would be.
It's pretty fast, right? Because it's a circle.
Yeah. So there's another paper from, or another figure from this paper that shows examples of what they're looking at. So for instance, Kepler-10b, the Kepler-10 system is a really famous example of this kind of architecture where there's one ultra short period planet, that's Kepler-10b, it's rocky, it's super close to the star, and then at 50 days there's Kepler-10c that everyone like forgets is there because it's not cool. But if you look at the transit shapes here, so they show what does it look like when they fix the inclination of the planet to 90 versus when they let the inclination float. So the point is, these are detected transits, and they're measurably different from being at I equals 90 degrees, which when you think about having a planet at 50 days, I don't remember what the inclination of Kepler-10c is off the top of my head, but it's really close to 90 because it transits.
Right.
But the point is that you get a lot of leverage on the inner planet because there's so many non-90 degree angles where you actually could very easily detect it transiting.
Yeah. But the only short period planet in this plot is the one on the left, right? The other two have much longer periods.
Do they have the date on?
I don't see the plot. Just based on the number of points in the stacked transit, I mean, Kepler-10b, you can barely tell the difference between the two fits, whereas the other two, which are much, I think, longer period, I mean, for sure you can tell the difference there because the transits are so much longer. Yeah.
If you zoom in on Kepler-10b, you can see that, like, there's really a pretty big difference.
Yeah, I mean that red line is a better fit than the blue line.
But I don't know if that quite addresses the issue with the other plot, because if we're saying that the short period impact parameters are wrong, that would maybe wipe out some of the points at the top, but I don't think it would. It doesn't really address the lack of points at the larger AR star.
But I thought it was the other way around, right? Weren't they arguing that somehow that shows the mechanism by which the ultra short period form?
So the point,
there were higher mutual inclinations, and that's a prediction of the model.
Right. So yeah, the point is that this observed distribution is consistent with the story that exoplanets form in dynamically cool multi-planet systems with the innermost planet sufficiently far from the star for everyone to feel comfortable. And then something happens sometimes that pumps up their mutual inclinations and eccentricities and results in the innermost planet getting close to the star. So they had cited the work of Petrovich et al. 2018, which is similar to the Pu et al. 2019 paper, except it deals in higher eccentricities, which might not be so good for your large hot Jupiters, but is totally fine for the short period. Or for the small planets.
So you either have to argue that you're going to miss the high mutual inclination ones at the high A of R star, or that the high A of R star short periods are bogus.
Yeah, no, that's true. I agree. So you'd have to maybe look at those top red points and see if
those are
really low.
Yeah.
They have very small A of R
star. No, I don't know which ones those are. Good.
All right, we have burning questions for this one right now, because otherwise I'd say we'd switch over to Brian's portion of the presentation. Yeah?
Cool. Okay, Brian.